I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Peter Bick. He is director and producer and cinematographer and just about everything else of the film Carbon Nation, which is part of the Santa Fe Farmers Market Wednesday night movie series. It's happening this coming Wednesday, the 29th of February at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So this film is a very wide-ranging and surprisingly uplifting movie about climate change, which is usually represented as a disaster in progress. What inspired you? What did you see that inspired you to put all of this together?
Basically, when we saw An Inconvenient Truth, I happened, luckily, was at Sundance for the world premiere of that, and something clicked inside of me. I mean, obviously that film's about the problem, and I didn't know about the problem, so it was very much an education experience for me. But something clicked, and I knew that I wanted to make a film about the solutions, and at that time I didn't know if there even were solutions. So along with our team that we put together, we went out to go find solutions, and we wanted to make a positive film from the beginning because I just knew that negative documentaries only go so far. And I knew how I felt when I watched negative, you know, downer stuff, that even if there's a problem, you got to help people find the solution or you're just going to create paralysis. And so we set out from the beginning to make something positive. Now, that being said, there were many, many days in the edit bay where I didn't know if we'd be able to do it and be truthful. So there were definitely some dark times, you know, because when you really delve into the science of climate, you learn how big things the problems are and you learn how big the scale of solutions need to be. It's really, really daunting. But we were lucky to find really inspiring people who were already doing compelling and powerful and scalable things so that I was able to sort of draw energy from the people on the videotape after a while because I wasn't with those guys but just a day or two. So it was the heroes of the movie that kept me going a lot through the editing. And then now that I'm showing the film, we've been on the road for a long time, almost 2 years, and seeing the response from audiences that they do get inspired, that then is keeping me charged up still. And I'm finding out so many new things. You know, the film, like we cover the Department of Defense in the movie, these guys called Green Hawks, right? You know,
yeah.
Trying to green up the Army and all the military. And, you know, when we started the film, there was definitely Green Hawks there, but they weren't in charge. Now I can honestly say the Secretary of the Navy is a Green Hawk, right? And so there's just so many more stories that I want to tell after the making of the film.
The film, for me, really underlined the reality that the climate change problem is not only a political problem, an industrial problem, but underneath it all, it's a math problem. Like, how much carbon is going into the air? How much can be taken back out of the air? How much energy can we make without putting any more of it into the air? And the answers to all these questions have numbers attached to them, which are very important, and we need to understand them. And one thing that I just found so fascinating about your film is there was a lot of math I didn't know. Like, and I thought we could talk about some of these things. One thing was that, okay, you've got people in your movie talking about electric-powered cars. And according to one of the speakers in the film, the electric cars are so much more efficient than gasoline-powered cars that even if the electricity used to run them comes from coal, they still use a lot less total carbon than gasoline. How can this be? How does that work?
Duncan. His last name's Duncan. He worked for Austin Electric. I always wanted to call it Austin Power. and I think that's the one typo that made it all the way through. I think we actually do call the Austin utility Austin Power in our movie.
That's funny.
Yeah, so you just described it very well, that it's less polluting to use electricity in a car, even if the electricity is made from coal, then powering a car with an internal combustion engine using gasoline. Those are numbers that he said that I'd heard from other folks as well. The physics of how that is, I couldn't spell out for you. But you know, you said that this was a math problem. I always say it was math and physics, right? Math, chemistry,
yeah.
Physics. It's those high school classes that's what this comes down to. But what he is saying is that the electric car does that very efficiently. Like, per electron used, it's more efficient. And so obviously, we don't want the electricity to be made from coal forever. Coal is very dirty, but it's still a positive going in that direction, even, no matter what your electricity is coming from. And also what they say in the film, which I found interesting and important, is that there's enough power generation capacity right now to power an awful lot of electric vehicles without building any more power plants, which is another concern of people. Like, what, are we just going to build a bunch of more coal plants? No, you don't need to, because those generation facilities actually, there's a lot of times where they're throwing electricity away. I just learned that. There's times when a utility would give you electricity if you could use it at 3 in the morning, because they can't off-gas it. They can't burn it away. It's got to get off the lines or it melts them.
Well, that's another thing that I thought was very interesting in the film, was the idea that if there were a lot of electric-powered cars that had batteries that they could plug in at night and actually use up some of the excess capacity that's being generated at night.
Yeah, and wasted. And what they say in the film, the guy from Southern California Edison, he's saying it's like a rolling storage. It's rolling batteries. And right now, one of the biggest hurdles to having a lot more solar and a lot more wind on our grid is that, wind doesn't blow all the time, solar doesn't shine all the time. How can you store that energy in big batteries so that you could use it so you could use solar energy at night? If we had enough of these plug-in hybrid vehicles, so it's not just electric, it's got to be a plug-in hybrid, because it's got to be a two-way, thing. And so when you have the plug-ins plugged in, then they can put energy into the system when they don't need it, and the system can give it back to the car when it needs it. So if I go to work and I've still got power in my battery and say I don't need the car until noon, then the utilities can then say, okay, we'll use your power from here till noon and we'll give you some power to get you home. And then it's all about the smart grid and smart meters, and it's new stuff. All that stuff's new stuff, where appliances are talking to, where the utilities can talk to your appliances and say, hey, refrigerator, you're going to go up a few degrees at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a hot summer day. The owner doesn't need to know it, and we will then not have to build another power plant, because that's the 3 days of the year that we need that power plant for those big peaks.
Right.
So much stuff that's coming down the pike that, I was just telling some people yesterday, we haven't even scratched the surface on this stuff. Haven't even scratched the surface. And last July in Spain, they had a solar thermal plant. Those solar towers, those giant towers that then reflect sunlight onto these big mirrors, the sunlight bounces off the big mirrors, is focused on the top of the tower, heats up a bunch of water or oil, and spins turbines, just sort of the old-fashioned way at that point. And they created electrons for 24 hours, even though the sun was down for 8 of those hours. They've figured out a way to store that power, and that's to heat up salt during the day with the excess energy they don't need. And then that salt is molten. It's like red hot. At night, it releases that heat, and you put water on it, steam, spins a turbine. So that was the first time on planet Earth that a solar plant actually produced electrons for 24 hours straight.
And fascinating.
It's a Kitty Hawk moment. It's a giant moment, and hardly anyone knew about it. There's just so much that hardly anyone knows. So many people are working on this stuff. There was over 500 solar patents applied for last year in the U.S. alone, over 400 wind technology patents in the U.S. alone. I mean, those are the people who got it together enough to make a patent, right? There's just thousands.
And here's another thing that nobody knows about. And again, it's another math thing. If you were to paint, and I don't know whether the guy meant all the roofs in the world or all the roofs in the United States, but if you were painting a very, very large majority of roofs white, not only do they cool buildings in warm climates, so it cuts way down on the electricity used by air conditioners, but they reflect sunlight and actually make up for the reflectivity of the melting sea ice, which is no longer reflecting sunlight back into the atmosphere and is causing this really bad positive feedback loop that causes the oceans to warm.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's just another one of those amazing, like every time I learn of a clean energy solution or an energy efficiency solution, all of a sudden the next thing that happens because of it is also a very good thing. Like the unintended benefits, right? And so, yeah, you study it, you study physics and you study heat, and you say, okay, let's paint the roof white. In the summer, a black roof in Chicago is going to be up to 180 degrees. And a green roof, if you just put plants on it, would be about 70, 75 degrees, and a white roof would be similar. So a white roof then basically makes it so that your building itself doesn't have to use its air conditioning as much, nor do your neighbors have to use their air conditioning as much. So all of a sudden, if you paint all the roofs white in a city, you're talking about tens of millions of dollars, depending on the size of the city, of energy savings. Now then you put that towards every state and everywhere on the planet, and what Art Rosenfeld was saying in the movie is that you can actually put a dent in how fast climate change is happening, like a big dent, a giant big dent.
Yeah, I mean, what he said was capping 7 years worth of climate change. That's almost unbelievable.
Yeah, so of the CO2 that we emit, 7 years of CO2 would be taken away. What he says it slows it down by 7 years.
By painting your roofs white.
Yeah, and everyone has to redo their roofs anyway. You know, roofs have to be redone. So it's really, he's talking really as much as the industrial big warehouse roofs, as big commercial roofs, as anything. But people's homes, let's say that you really, really, really don't like white. Well, there's this stuff now called cool colors that it basically works. It basically makes it so that the color is visible that we see is fine, but in the infrared spectrum, it doesn't absorb heat like a normal paint would. So it still can reflect light back, and you still would have the color you want. It's not as efficient as white, but it's definitely on the right path.
It's pretty close. Well, another question I had about that was, I mean, if white roofs keep your buildings cool in the summer, do black roofs keep your building warm in the winter? Is that an advantage?
I asked that question to Art and to another guy who's a science advisor to us, a guy named Saul Griffith. And the way they explained it to me was basically let's talk about the Northern Hemisphere right now. The sun is very direct on buildings in the Northern Hemisphere during the summer. So you're getting a really strong savings of heat reduction.
Oh, okay,
with that white, right? But in the winter, the sun is way down on the horizon. So it's not heating up that black roof as much as it would. You're
right.
Not getting as much of an effect. But the albedo effect is still very effective. So that albedo effect is what you talked about, where it's replacing, you know, this ice that used to cover the northern oceans is now gone. And so the benefits all calculated, you have much more benefit from a white roof than you would from a black roof.
We're talking to Peter Bick, the director of the film Carbon Nation. So there's a lot of other really interesting things that happen in the film, and one of them is even people who really are not on board with climate change, and even though the evidence is overwhelming, the PR backlash has also been overwhelming, and you've got a guy who's doing geothermal power in Alaska, which using water, which is well below the boiling point, is generating super cheap electricity, and he doesn't even believe in man-made climate change.
Yeah, that guy's name is Bernie Carl, and you're right. He's basically the pioneer with low temperature geothermal power, which then makes it so that you can put geothermal power generators in just many, 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 many more places. You don't need that 300 to 400 degree steam, and no one thought that could be done. He did it. Some companies, UTC Power, heard about him, partnered with him, and so this thing's going to take off. It probably already would have taken off if we didn't have the downturn when we did. Before the downturn, Goldman Sachs was predicting that he was going to sell 250,000 of these things in the next, you know, foreseeable future. So when we interviewed him, I asked him, I said, do you believe in climate change? Because I started asking people that, and he said, no. He didn't think humans were causing it. He thinks that climate change is happening, but he didn't think humans were affecting it, or if we were affecting it, very, very little. And he says, but that doesn't matter. I like clean air and I like clean water. You know, and in the footage that we just couldn't fit into the film, he's like, hey, if you want to build a power plant, that's great. Just don't have any waste.
So he believes, I mean, the whole idea of believing in climate change is, to me, it's sort of like saying, do you believe in Bolivia?
Right.
You know, it's not a question of belief, but that aside, yeah, he is doing it from this place of wanting clean air and wanting to generate really inexpensive electricity.
Yeah, and he's doing it. And the really important thing about Bernie and the evolution of the film and the evolution of the approach of the film, like I said, we wanted to make a positive film. We also wanted to make a big tent film. We wanted to make a film that wasn't just folks who believed in climate change that would benefit from the movie. Because as we were learning all these benefits of solutions, there's benefits whether you believe in climate change or not. And then we meet Bernie, and it's like, look what he's doing. He's going to do more to affect climate change than I ever will. And he doesn't believe humans are causing it. It's like, all of a sudden, I didn't care that much that he didn't believe humans were causing it, because look what he's doing. And I realized that I think that by having this big, heavy doorman outside the club of climate, you know, of solutions, saying if you don't believe in climate change, you can't come in, that we're excluding an awful lot of very smart people. The climate change debate, the fact that we debate it, is by design. It's a game plan that was hashed 30 years ago and 20 years ago, and it's exactly what it was supposed to do. Seed doubt, science still isn't conclusive, and all that stuff. So all that's just exactly by design by the folks who want to just sort of keep things the way they are. And it's not surprising. It's not really healthy for the planet, but it's not surprising. But there's so many people who don't want to be told what to do by folks who they think are hypocrites. You know, you just ask people and they think, well, if you're flying in a plane, you're saying you can't put carbon in the air, you must, you know. And so they say that's hypocritical. If you build a big giant house and you're not, you know, and you're championing, you know, you're saying that climate change is bad, well, wait a second. What are you saying? But we need everybody on board. This thing's too big. So I don't care why someone comes in the room, as long as they're coming in the room and doing something positive.
Well, this is what I want to ask you. When you screen this film, are you screening to people who theretofore had been full of doubt about the existence of man-made climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. And all of them love the movie. They love that we don't blame them. They love that we don't make politics out of it. They love that it's solutions. They like that it's funny. You know, and there's studies of how to communicate climate to conservatives, and they're coming up with these sorts of pieces. And then I'd have conversations with the skeptics after the screening, and we talk about it, and they sort of list out what they think climate change is, and I list out what I think climate change is, and I say, okay, let's just table that. Let's now focus on the other stuff. Let's see what we agree on. And we agree on so much other stuff, so much so that in my conversations over the last 2 years on the road, I'm convinced that we are not a polarized country.
I think
we're just being told we are. And a lot of people are acting as if because they know I hate them. They know before they meet me, if I've made a film about climate change, that I must hate them. And so they're going to act as if I hate them. So we're not going to get much communication going. But when I sit down with anyone and talk about this stuff, anyone, anywhere, there's huge, huge agreement. And it was surprising for me at first, and now I know to expect it, and it's exciting. And that's really what I've learned showing the film is this. And so the idea that we're not a polarized country to me is very exciting. When I speak to a skeptic or a conservative and we start spelling out what we want for the country, we kind of look at each other and we realize we don't hate each other. We're actually not enemies. And look how much we agree. Wait a second. And there's a sense of relief. There's a real sense of relief. When you find out someone you thought hated you doesn't and is actually in agreement with you, it's very exciting. And so you have to ask yourself, who's benefiting from this theory of polarization? It's pretty obvious. The political parties benefit from it. TV networks benefit from it. They sell commercials. They make money. You know, so there's an entire industry that benefits from this idea of polarization. You know, this idea that you have to have two sides to every story. Well, I could show you a bunch of stories that have eight sides or seven sides, right?
Well, above all, the fossil fuel companies, if I may say so, are the ones benefiting from that polarization, particularly around climate change, because they get to do business as usual no matter what the harm to the planet.
Yeah, no question. There's no question that anyone in the fossil fuel business wants to continue selling fossil fuels. And I shouldn't be surprised by that. I used to be, but I'm not. And I actually can tell you that they're the best storytellers in our society right now. They're the best ones. They're the most effective. They know exactly how to tell the story. So the people who want a clean energy economy got to be better storytellers.
Well, this is a great story, this film, Carbon Nation. It's just fascinating. Because, I mean, I have to say, I started watching the DVD at home thinking, oh boy, they're going to tell me stuff I already know and I'm going to be depressed. And it was exactly the opposite. It was full of all kinds of things that I didn't know, and it was really exciting. And one of the, okay, here's another one. Let's talk about another one of these things that nobody knows about, is manufacturing companies that are using energy. Then they start capturing this energy and they're generating electricity at a profit that powers their own manufacturing companies by putting in the infrastructure to capture what was essentially completely 100% wasted power.
Yeah, well, especially in the steel business, if you're talking about the guy who says, even if you're a greedy bastard, you'd want to
do
this. So that guy named Sean Kasten, he does a lot of blogging on Grist, and he's fascinating. This guy's so brilliant, it hurts when I get emails from him. But, yeah, what they're doing is you take a steel factory. The heat coming out of the smokestack from all that process is enormous. And that's just wasted energy, heat. And so they capture the heat, create steam, spin turbines, make electricity. The electricity, all the costs of that still make cheaper electricity than if the power plant was buying it from the local utility. And, you know, if you did that worldwide, you could cut carbon emissions by a fifth.
A fifth, that's a lot.
That's how much carbon is emitted from burning all the rainforests. That's how much carbon is emitted from the transportation systems.
So you fix the transportation system, you stop burning down the rainforest, and you do what you're talking about, capturing heat from these manufacturing plants, and three-fifths, 60% of the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere is taken away.
And no one's quality of life has changed.
Right, exactly.
And that's the sort of the guiding principle for energy efficiency is, you know, you can have your 1975 refrigerator or you could have your 2012 refrigerator that's going to use 25% of the energy. And guess what? It's going to do it a lot better. And guess what? When you throw it away, it's not going to be such a toxic greenhouse gas time bomb like the old ones.
And you've got a wonderful man who's on in your film who's recycling the old ones, too, which is a beautiful story in itself. Now, let's see. There's a couple of others that I wanted to mention. Well, there's so many that we could mention. Stonyfield Farms is building a wastewater. They built a wastewater treatment plant that uses the gas from the waste to operate the facility to make energy from the facility, and that actually makes money. Their wastewater treatment, instead of costing money, makes a profit.
Right, because they'd gotten big enough that they couldn't just send their untreated waste into the city's system. Because at a certain point, if you're a business, the city puts a limit on what you can put in for them to have to clean and treat. And so they had to build a wastewater treatment plant to then be able to put their waste had to be cleaned up before their water could go back into the system. And then they realized that if they could just capture the gas from that waste before they treated it, that they could actually create, you know, it's basically methane, and burn it to power that wastewater treatment plant. So, you know, it's actually making them money. They're creating a profit center from it as opposed to a cost center.
And Dow Chemical did something. They put, I think it was $1 billion into energy efficiency and retrofitting of that nature, and got $9 billion of savings in return.
Yeah, it's, and that was over from a period of from 1994 to 2009. So they spent $1 billion on energy efficiency programs within their company. I don't think of Dow as like the environmental steward, right? But they've done, which is the whole story. They're doing it because it's good business. And that's good, because that's how things get done. There are going to be companies that do it because it's good for the environment. Like Stonyfield is there for all the reasons. They want to do it for the environment. They want to do it for business, right? And they want to do it for health. They've got sort of all the reasons lined up. There's plenty of companies that don't have all the reasons lined up, but they're still doing it because it saves money. And so if you spend a lot of money on energy efficiency, I mean, that one's a really wild story, because we're told, I've been told a number of times, that if you in your home spend a dollar on energy efficiency, you get $2 back in energy savings. Like, that's the formula I keep hearing. So look what Dow did. They were, you know, they figured out how to make their products with a lot less energy. You know, they tasked their employees and their scientists and their engineers to do it. And when you do that, as a CEO, when you say to your employees, do this and use less energy, the employees love it. And they don't come in, they don't call in as sick as much. They don't quit their job as much, so you don't have to retrain new people. And they become the best recruiter you can have for the new people, because they're still there and they like it. So again, you peel it back and all these amazing things happen. And when you do that stuff, your stock goes up. And when you tell people about it, your stock goes up.
Right.
So there's just all these amazingly good reasons to do it. Now, that being said, not everything that companies need or want to do saves money. SC Johnson's a company that we filmed, and they have a thing where it's called Greenlist, where they've tasked everyone to use less harmful products in the making of their products. They make Ziploc, which is one of my favorite products. And I was taught by a friend 20 years ago to wash them and reuse them. You know, it's like, don't know if that's good news for SC Johnson, but I reuse Ziplocs a lot, and they last because they're thick. And so what they do at SC Johnson is they have this thing called Greenlist. So tasking everyone to use less harmful chemicals in the processes, besides more energy efficient stuff. And their CEO says 7 out of 10 times it saves money, 3 out of 10 times it doesn't. But he's still choosing to do it anyway, because they too have a bigger mission in mind. They have a long family tradition of trying to figure out how to do this stuff as clean as possible. And there's a great story there where he and his father, and his father's not known as a real green guy, wasn't known, but there was going to be a new coal plant being built in Racine, Wisconsin, and they decided to fight it. And they took it all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and lost 3-2. But they were out there marching. The heads of SC Johnson were marching. And the sweet revenge is they discovered that they had enough methane coming off the landfill near their plant. They now power their plant with methane gas from the landfill, and they don't use any of that power from that coal plant.
Very interesting. Now, the film that we're talking about, Carbon Nation, has solutions to greenhouse gas problem that are on so many levels. You have an individual level, you have municipal levels, you show people retrofitting the Empire State Building, you've got green roofs on city buildings, you've got Van Jones envisioning an economy in which solar panel installation and green building is a huge driver of the economy and also helps inner city neighborhoods and all that. And basically, you know, and so a lot of the solutions are there. Some research and development is still needed on things like energy storage and some other things, but a lot of it is still there, and yet as a nation, we haven't embraced it yet. And you make the point a couple of times during the film that one thing that is utterly crucial that is needed in order for these things to happen is a carbon tax. First of all, why? And second, why is it so hard to get that done?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I'm going to start a little further back behind that question about what is a carbon tax and are we paying a carbon tax right now, but no one's telling us. And I will tell you that we are paying an enormous carbon tax right now that no one's telling us we're paying. And I would say that putting a price on carbon will reduce that carbon tax. The School of Public Health at Harvard a year ago put out a study that looked at how much does it cost to use coal as a fuel in the United States on an annual basis. What are the costs that aren't on my utility bill? Because we use a lot of coal here in Kentucky where I live. And these costs aren't on the utility. They're not on their books, and they're not on the coal company who's digging up the coal's books. The cost to the environment when you take a mountain away and you take away all that water purification capability, you have to build more water purification plants. It's going to cost money. When you have trucks rolling up and down highways over and over and over again to bring the coal here and there, if it's not being put on a barge, those roads have to be rebuilt. It's not an environmental statement. It's just, again, just physics. And when you have coal plants emitting all the toxins that they emit, children especially get asthma, and that has a cost. And when they added up all those costs, it's between one-third and one-half $1 trillion annually that Americans pay in and above their utility bills as a result of coal as a fuel. That doesn't talk about gasoline or any of the other or natural gas. It's just talking about coal. So in Kentucky, we pay 5 cents a kilowatt hour. That roughly translates to 17 more cents a kilowatt hour if it was internalized into our bill. And that's a huge carbon tax that we're paying right now that no one's talking about. Again, it's storytelling. You're not going to hear that from the folks who are selling coal. They have no reason to tell you that. But that's the truth. That is the tax we're paying. So the idea of putting a price on carbon is to internalize, is to get some of those real costs that this stuff really costs into the product. So that if you, you know, carbon, fossil fuels, basically, I think they predict it's about 2,000 entry points on a major level into the economy, like at big levels. You know, like if you said Chevron was one of those entry points, you know, there's about 2,000 spots where it comes into the economy. If you tax it right there, you say, okay, we're going to put a price on carbon, and we're going to say, you know, for every ton of carbon that this product will emit, it'll cost $10 or $15 or $20. Obviously, fossil fuels are going to get more expensive, and there's going to be a market incentive. Everyone talks about free market, but I haven't found a free market yet. There's subsidies everywhere. I don't know of a free market, but let's say you're talking about market-based solutions. Well, then you basically give a signal. Okay, market, fossil fuels and cost more. So what else you got? Because everyone wants to go the cheapest route.
Right. Now,
so I say that carbon, certainly coal, is artificially cheap. It's artificially cheap. It's not reality, and it's definitely not free market. Not even close.
Yeah.
You know, there's not one oil well in the United States and not one coal mine in the United States and not one natural gas drilling site that isn't in some way or form subsidized.
Very interesting.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing to me. So that's why we say a price on carbon in the film. But, you know, to get that is, it's starting. You know, California is doing it. They're partnering with different states and a couple of different provinces in Canada. But I got to tell you, this stuff's just eventually, and it's going to be sooner than people think, solar and wind is going to be cheaper than coal.
Peter Bick is the director and producer of Carbon Nation. It's part of the Santa Fe Farmers Market Wednesday night movie series. It's on Wednesday, February 29th at 7 in the evening at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion on Paseo de Peralta. For more information, farmersmarketinstitute.org or 505-983-7726. And what's your website?
It's carbonnationmovie.com.
carbonnationmovie.com. Thanks so much. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Tallulah St. James. She's with the Circus Erotique Burlesque Company, which will be performing this Friday night at 8 o'clock at the CCA here in Santa Fe, along with a screening of Frederick Wiseman's new film, Crazy Horse, which is also a documentary about burlesque in Paris. And the company will also be performing at the Lodge on Sunday night at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you. Very glad to be here.
What is burlesque?
I think when people learn that I do burlesque, there's all these visions that come into people's minds about a pole and stripping and, you know, maybe images from the 30s and 40s. But essentially, burlesque is a parody or poking fun at either something that might be sexual or political. So we have our burlesque company, and we do a lot of classic burlesque dancing. But every piece and performance has a theme or a story that goes along with it. It's just not someone getting up there and taking off their clothes. It, you know, it could be a character or, for instance, we had our fairy tale show, and there were fairy tale characters based like on Snow White or something like that. So it all involves a theme, and it's a parody and satirical, and then it also pokes fun at sensuality and sexuality.
And with the purpose of what? I mean, what are you giving to the people in your audience? Are you trying to make them laugh? Are you trying to turn them on?
a little bit of both. You know, one of the best compliments that I get after performing is coming off stage and having a woman come up to me and say, you know, Tallulah, that was amazing. I never thought that I would enjoy watching women on stage dancing and take off their clothes. More or less because our company has a variety of body shapes. And just the appreciation of the female body and also male bodies, because we do have male dancers who also get up there, boylesque dancers. So we do want people to laugh, and then we do want people to look at our costumes that we put into lots of work. And just to have fun. It's nothing that you would really have to think about. It's just more of a eye candy.
Now, when you say, okay, women in the audience come up to you, is your audience 50-50 mixed men and women, or is it more men?
Let's see. We've been doing these shows for about 3-4 years now, and it's usually a mix. I would just have to say a mix. So, and all ages, too. Sometimes, you know, it being at the lodge, we do get people who come in that are tourists in Santa Fe, and they may be in their 60s or 70s. And then we have people who, you know, our shows are 18 and up. So we get all different ages. And
now, when I think of burlesque, and I was looking at some of the photographs, I haven't seen your show, but I was looking at your website, which, by the way, is zeburlesque.com. There is kind of a feeling of a turn of the previous century, or like maybe Paris in the 20s sense of costume. And I was thinking, you know, that's a time where there were so many both cultural and legal taboos around the body and around sexuality, which are gone now.
Yes.
But you're still kind of keeping that look.
Yes. Talking about that, you know, since I've been a dancer my entire life, and I went into burlesque in 2008, coming from New Orleans, I saw burlesque and on stage at the Shim Sham Club and was introduced to it at an early age. And, you know,
an early age?
Early. you can be 17 or 18 to get in the club in New Orleans.
So I thought you meant like 5 or something.
No, not that young. For myself, I tend to stick more with a classic burlesque, more of a 30s and 40s feel. And back then, whenever burlesque started, they had a group, and they were a can-can group, and their big taboo was that they showed their ankles. You know, and then you get into more of a vaudeville show to where it's comedians, and then they'll have the dancing girl come in. And if you look at these old documentaries from the 30s and 40s, they do a reveal, but then they go off stage and reveal and then come back on stage in full nudity and then go back off stage. So it's kind of like this cut and paste type thing. And something else I like to address is that, you know, when the TV came around and people could just have everything at home, and then you look at the way sexuality has changed throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s to where, you know, you could go to a strip club or you could rent a porn or whatever like that. But with us, what we're trying to do is maintain that, you know, maybe she won't take off all of her clothes. It's more of a heightened just waiting, that anticipation of what's going to come off next. So some of our dance numbers don't even have reveals, you know, but there's still a definite element of that sensuality and sexuality on stage.
When you get to the moment in the show where, I mean, at some point you first did, I never heard the word reveal, but you first did a so-called reveal. That must be like a coming-of-age ritual or something for a burlesque dancer.
Since I've been the director of this troupe, I've been very fortunate to take dancers and, you know, they create their stage name and their presence and costume and style and theme, and it never fails that after their first performance of doing the full reveal, whether they show their breast or not, they come off stage and they just cry from exhilaration and nervousness and exhaustion of just this whole, you know, you do reveal more than just your body. It's also, you know, you're revealing something that can be considered vulnerable on stage. So,
are the dancers, the female dancers, vulnerable? Do they have to be careful when they walk to their cars, that kind of thing?
We always take precaution. The lodge is wonderful. We've never had any issues. So every venue that I've worked with, I've been very careful to see, you know, what kind of crowd it is. We don't just do house parties or anything like that. We always make sure that we're on stage as performers. We're not in any way, shape, or form do you make money off of doing burlesque. So it's...
You don't?
No. If we can pay for our costumes, that's the best thing that we can ask for, because there's so much work and detailed and crystals and appliques that go into the costume, because you can't walk into a store and say, I want a burlesque costume. There's certain things you want it to come off, right? And so a lot of them are hand-sewn. So if we can just cover the cost of costumes, that's what we're happy about.
We're talking to Tallulah St. James of the Zirkus Erotique Burlesque Company. So what is the music like? What kind of music do you choose for your different numbers?
Well, we just performed at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque for their Southwest Showcase. And we did a group number. And there's the song Beyoncé's Crazy in Love, right? Very modern pop song. But there's a someone redid it. I forget. Just a cover of it. And it's done by the Pupini Sisters, which is a lot like the Andrew Sisters of the 40s.
Uh-huh.
So they take a modern song and then they make it into this 40s style. And it's, you know,
Like three-part harmony.
Right. And it's very kind of Bugle Boy and that revelry type thing. So my music that I stick to for Tallulah, it's more classic. A lot of big band and jazz sounds. But then for our group numbers, it can be different things. And then each character or each dancer or whatever the theme of the show is, pick and choose. So it could be anything from classic to modern rock. I mean, anything.
So does each dancer have her own number?
Yeah, and we have multitudes of numbers from doing all these shows. We've had shows that are based around maybe animals. So people dress up in costume as animals and do cute numbers. And then the most recent one we did, Once Upon a Time in Bed, was a play. There was no MC. It was we had two actors come in and play the parts, and then the dancers created their numbers around that and went back and forth. So it was a really unique show.
Is there normally an MC?
Yes. MCs are really key to the burlesque shows because they engage the audience, because the last thing a burlesque dancer wants to do is go on stage and have the audience quiet and hear crickets, because it's not comfortable to do any type of reveals or move clothing to complete silence. So one of the jobs of the MC is to introduce the audience to the stage and to the dancers, and the more you cheer, the more involved the dancers can be, because it's definitely a play part. So we want to be involved with the audience as far as getting that response and the whistling and clapping.
So your performance must be so dependent on the energy of any particular audience.
Yes, and being a dancer for a long time, and I belly danced here in Santa Fe for about 7 years, I got used to performing for smaller groups and having that intimacy with audience members being very close. One of the benefits of being on stage is being removed from the kind of that intimacy, but it's still, you want to make eye contact and you want to make sure that you know that they're there, and vice versa.
Now, you have dancers who have come from, your performers, I guess you would say, who have come from dance and theater, mm-hmm. of all kinds, belly dance, classical, ballet, things like that.
Yes.
Do you also have people who've come from the world of, like, strip clubs?
In Zirkus, let's see. No, we haven't. But it's not uncommon for a lot of girls to start off that way and start off into, you know, an exotic dancer or strip clubs. But then, you know, I think mainly people transition into the burlesque is because they want a little bit more costumes and more interaction.
And so more than, say, belly dancing gave you?
Yes. As a dancer, I've I've always appreciated every type of dance, and with the burlesque, you can have more of a theater and that vaudeville feel, and it's just more expressive, and you can take on a character rather being autonomous as far as like a chorus line or a group goes.
Now, Tallulah St. James is your stage name.
That's correct.
How did you choose that?
Originally from Louisiana, outside of New Orleans, by the Gulf Coast, there's a town that we'd always drive through called Tallulah, Louisiana. And it's beautiful and has a plantation, this horrible story about, a young man fell in love with a woman and built her this huge plantation, but then she left him. But it's just such a beautiful town, and I love the Tallulah. And St. James is the reference, of course, to New Orleans, so
right,
keeping it in the South.
The film Crazy Horse is screening, along with your performance, yeah, with Circus Erotique, on Friday night at the CC tomorrow at the CCA here in Santa Fe. And both you and I have just screened before the fact this film Crazy Horse, which is about this place in Paris, a burlesque show.
Yes.
And it was just fascinating to me that the people who are directing it, they treat it as a high art form, or as an art form every bit as much as a ballet choreographer or anything like that.
Yes. You know, I was doing some research about that because I like to find out where things come from. And it was a family-owned business since 1951, and something that is very, specific to Crazy Horse is that they want all the dancers to be indistinguishable. So they want all the girls to be kind of cookie cutter forms so they can create these visual art pieces, and using a lot of lighting. And there's not so much as far as reveal goes. Their costuming is very minimal, but it's very beautiful. And I mean, it came out in the 1950s, and it still remains, you know, like it said, the gold standard in burlesque today. A lot of modern dancers, Carmen Electra and Dita Von Teese, have performed there, and now they have the Crazy Horse in Las Vegas.
Once you're in burlesque, can you go into other forms of dance, modern dance, whatever? It's
sure.
It's not like a kind of red flag on your record or something like that.
I would hope not.
Well, you never know. We live in such a kind of, in some ways, sexually weird culture.
It's true. You know, it's with burlesque, and I'm glad that CCA is viewing this movie or screening this movie for the public is to give kind of an inside view of it, you know, the behind the stage things. You know, in my day job, when I'm not involved with Zirkus, is extremely sexually restrictive. So I guess, how would you say it? Being able to watch this movie and see what goes into it and the involvement and the costumes and that stuff, I guess, makes it more important and valuable as artwork. Because we can look at our day jobs and it's very mundane, but to add some excitement into it, I think that's what people need more.
Tallulah St. James is with Zirkus Erotique Burlesque Company. They're on the web at zeburlesque.com. And in addition to the event at the CCA tomorrow night, which is, by the way, presented by The Onion, there is also a performance on Sunday night by Zirkus at 8 o'clock at the Lodge. Doors open at 7 o'clock. Tallulah, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.